The three men said to Abraham, "Where is your wife Sarah?" And he said, "There, in the tent." Then one said, "I will surely return to you in due season, and your wife Sarah shall have a son." And Sarah was listening at the tent entrance behind him. Sarah laughed to herself. For most of the 7 years that my wife Carrie and I were in Minnesota, we lived in St. Louis Park, which is a first-ring suburb of Minneapolis. And our local grocery store there had a huge kosher section, and that's something that I'd never seen before in the grocery store. I knew that a lot of Jews lived in our particular city. I knew that it was the hometown of Al Franken, the Jewish comedian turned United States Senator, and the Coen brothers, Jewish filmmakers whose works include Fargo, The Big Lebowski, and No Country for Old Men. But I really didn't know very much about the history behind all of that. How did that come to be? By 1987, St. Louis Park was home to 38% of the Jewish population in the Minneapolis area. Jews moved there at an accelerated pace in the 1950s and 60s. It was one of the few suburbs with no restrictions on Jewish access to housing. Although it may be hard to believe, given the reputation of the so-called Minneapolis today, an article in 1946 described Minneapolis as, quote, "the capital of anti-Semitism in the United States." Jews, for example, were refused membership in service, athletic, or even automobile clubs. They were routinely denied job interviews. It was difficult for them even to rent property in parts of Minneapolis. Some of this, I'm ashamed to say, was done by Christians in the name of God. And that's because many fundamentalist groups that were openly anti-Semitic were headquartered in Minneapolis at the time. Now, in spite of those closed doors, in spite of all of that hostility, Jewish communities and Jewish congregations endured and thrived from one generation to the next within and beyond the city limits of St. Louis Park. For example, there's a really interesting synagogue in nearby Minnetonka that built a new worship space for their congregation in 2003. And the first thing that's interesting about it is that their sanctuary is at the center of all the facilities. It symbolizes the reality that prayer and the study of Torah, which is housed there, is at the heart of their mission to practice their Judaism together, not only in that synagogue, but also in the world around them. But there's something else about their sanctuary that symbolizes their relationship with that world. The rabbi who was there when the new building was built said this at the beginning of one of his sermons. He said, "The billowing white canopies above the entrance doors of Beit Shalom remind us of the open flaps of Abraham and Sarah's tent, where people were provided sanctuary." Quite frankly, I find it astonishing that they can find the strength to be so welcoming not only to friends, but also to strangers, too many of whom were cruel to their blood ancestors, or at least to their spiritual ancestors, really not that long ago. Truth be told, it can be hard for any of us to imitate Abraham and Sarah's hospitality by the oaks of Mamre. We might be afraid of the past. We might be afraid of violence. We might be afraid of the current political climate, whether we're liberal, conservative, or somewhere in between. We might be afraid of people who don't look like us because of their skin color or how they dress. We might be afraid of people who ask different questions about the divine than we do because they worry about different things than we do. There are all sorts of reasons, some of them seriously legitimate ones, to close the doors and lock them just as the disciples would do after the crucifixion of Jesus. They locked the doors of the same room where Jesus broke the bread and poured the wine on the night before he died. Of course, you and I can also live that way without ever installing a lock or physically turning it to keep the door shut. We can simply close our hearts to those outside our close-knit circle of friends. So does hearing that somehow magically turn us into enlightened Christians with open minds who can just be like Abraham and Sarah in today's version of the wilderness? Should we just give ourselves a pat on the back and live our lives exactly like them? If that's what you think, you've not read about the real lives of Abraham and Sarah as they are described in the pages of the Bible. Abraham had one child by an Egyptian slave girl named Hagar, who became his second wife. And that whole situation, by the way, was his first wife Sarah's idea. That's how that came to be. As we heard in today's first reading from Genesis, Abraham would later have a second child born to Sarah. And without going into all the details, let's just say that Abraham was never going to win a Father of the Year award for his relationship with either of his sons. I doubt they sent him cards or cuneiform tablets on the ancient Near East version of Father's Day. And what about Sarah? One of my friends who happens to be named Sarah recently said, "We always talk about how great Sarah is. She sent Hagar away with a baby to die in the desert." And I don't want to hear about your Old Testament scholarship nonsense about how women have to do this. I don't want to hear that. She sent her away with a baby. Now, I'm not sure if my friend was referring to the first time that Sarah drove Hagar away before Hagar had given birth because she felt slighted by the newly pregnant Hagar, or the second time that Sarah drove Hagar away, this time for good, together with Hagar's son, her baby, who would have been a young teenager at that point. It doesn't matter. You get the point, hopefully. Sarah, who not only laughed but also lied about laughing at God's promise for her, was just as messed up as you and I are. The truth is that we do live our lives like Abraham and Sarah did, even if it's just a shadow of their spectacular failures. As my friend named Sarah also said, so what does God do with jackwagons? This is an important question. For one thing, she said, he does not affirm them. He loves them. He loves us. He saves us. God sees us, and he has seen us for a very long time. He was there when Sarah sent Hagar away with a baby. I would add to my friend's observation that God was there when Sarah laughed at his promise to her. He was there when Sarah laughed again after that promise had become a reality. He was there in the laughter that she shared with friends and everyone else who heard her story. The good news is that in Jesus Christ, God's one-way love reaches the unloved and the unlovely. His mercy embraces strangers outside the tent, where the landscape is too often marked by harshness and hatred. But it also embraces those who struggle daily to survive inside the tent. There we crowd our lives with invisible furniture such as jealousy, bitterness, comparison, unforgiveness, and self-righteousness. There we too laugh at God's grace, unmerited and undeserved, which sounds so very ridiculous in the ears of those who've been around the block a time or two. Yet, as the German theologian Jürgen Moltmann so beautifully describes all of human history, past, present, and future, in a single sentence, God weeps with us so that we may someday laugh with him. This I believe for Sarah and her son Isaac, for Hagar and her son Ishmael, for Abraham and the rest of his dysfunctional family, for you, for me, and all of our relationships. After all, is anything too wonderful for the Lord? Amen.